This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. We're devoting this week to conversations about science. Earlier this week, we talked about psychopaths on the show, the 1% of the population that commits an estimated 30% of violent crimes, people who can kill without feeling. And the critical point about psychopaths is they lack empathy. So what is empathy? Why do we ask children to consider other people's feelings? And why do we ourselves try to walk in their shoes? Lasana Harris is an assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. Jesse Prinz is distinguished professor of philosophy at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And they are both with me today. Lasana, Jesse, welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Delighted to be here.
Lasana, you do research on empathy in your lab. So how do you define empathy?
Empathy is a very special construct for us because empathy involves getting inside the person's head, understanding what they're feeling, feeling that yourself, and finally being motivated to help them. So we often think about empathy in terms of negative things. So if someone is feeling sad today, we try to understand why they're feeling sad. We end up feeling sad ourselves, and we're motivated to help them feel better. So that's our definition.
That's a key, that what you said at the end, that we're actually motivated to help. So it's more than just kind of knowing what you're thinking.
Exactly.
And perhaps even feeling what you're feeling.
Exactly. It's the helping component that makes empathy unique. Now, that's a very social psychological definition of empathy, but it's one that I think works really well because it separates empathy from similar processes like thinking about someone else's mind, understanding what they're feeling.
All right. And this word, Jesse, empathy, it turns out it may have been part of us from the beginning of our differentiation as a species, if it is different from other species. But the word itself is relatively recent, Jesse. Can you explain it to us and how long we've been talking about empathy?
That's right. It's really a 19th century word. It came in German originally. The word in German is Einfühlen. And German had a word for sympathy, which is a much older word, Mitfühlen, which means feeling with. And you can think about sympathy as something like feeling bad for a person. But empathy is really putting yourself in their shoes, feeling into, as it were. And that idea is really pretty new, but it's taken off in contemporary science.
And it really is linked with moral action. How did that happen? When did that link? Were they always linked?
In the 17th century and 18th century, you begin to get a lot of philosophical theories relating emotion to morality. And for a philosopher like David Hume, writing in the 1730s, it was really emotions that compelled us to take care of each other, to do things for each other, to have concern for your fellow person. And I think that for Hume, the emotions were really things more like guilt or anger. But he began to talk about sympathy as well. And I think it was those seeds in British moral thought and Scottish moral thought that ultimately inspired subsequent generations of moral theorists.
So that's when people begin thinking about it. They talk about it. They're watching behavior. Lasana, in recent times, of course, we have the ability to look at it and the technology to look at it more scientifically. What does science tell us about empathy?
Sure. Science tells us that empathy is very special. So empathy, like many complex constructs, doesn't rely on a singular brain structure. It relies on a network. And we've done lots of science looking at empathy for pain, for instance. And so we've been able to look in the brain while people observe other people that they either care about or don't, experiencing pain. And we found that parts of your brain that are active when you yourself experience pain become active when you're observing someone else experiencing pain. And the degree to which it's active depends on how close that person is to you. So if it's your significant other, those regions are much more active. So in essence, if you looked in the brain of the person experiencing the painful event and the brain of the person observing the person experience a painful event, they're very similar activation patterns. So that's what's unique about empathy. Not only do you have the capacity to experience what the person is experiencing, but your brain is literally expressing that experience in a very similar manner.
And these are the so-called mirror neurons?
Right. So it depends on the type of empathy. So empathy for pain relies on a pain matrix in the brain involving regions like anterior cingulate cortex, anterior insula. But if you shift the type of empathic experience, you can shift the activation patterns. And so you will get regions involved in mirror neurons, for instance, becoming more active depending on exactly what it is the person's experiencing.
And as it gets down to the what we would consider the emotional level, that part of the brain that experiences things without being able to particularly articulate it, that's when we might be motivated to act and not just think about what it must be like to have a bleeding finger at the moment.
Exactly. Emotions are very powerful drivers of our behavior. And so emotions get us to do things. And so if you're experiencing pain, and let's consider pain an emotion in this case, you're going to be motivated to do things to alleviate that pain. It's the same idea with empathy. If I'm actually experiencing the specific distress of the other person, I'm going to be motivated to alleviate that distress. And so the motivational component is key.
Jesse, Lasana said something interesting just a second ago. The closer you are in relationship to that person, the more active the brain becomes. This takes us to the other side of empathy, so often associated with progressive ideas about collaboration and nurturing. And yet if we don't identify with a group of people and identify them as other, empathy can really be a kind of a very negative human structure, right?
I believe that very strongly. I actually think that our investment in empathy as a crucial moral emotion may be misplaced, that empathy helps us form a sense of concern for people similar to us, but it may be very difficult to cultivate when we're dealing with members of other groups. So if we're trying to invest in cultivating an attitude that makes people concerned for other groups, empathy might not be the way to go. Study after study has shown that when people, for example, look at the face of a member of an out-group, a different ethnic group, for instance, experiencing pain, there's less response. In fact, brain areas that are involved in face recognition are less active when looking at a member of a different ethnic group than your own, as if you don't even see them as having a human face. And I think that's a huge obstacle to overcome if we're trying to get people to develop a sense of concern for others.
Couple that, the sort of diminishing sense of identification with those who don't look like you, with a sense of identification with perhaps a pain, perceived, actual or otherwise, among your group. So if they're doing this to us, and I can convince you of that, and they don't elicit as much of a response as us do, then that's really what generates these kind of homophobic behavior, Islamophobic, anti-Semitic, all of them, racism. I guess that could be empathy then, Lasana, might be the basis of for those behaviors as well.
Yeah, I think that's true as well. And a lot of our own research in my lab looks at when empathy is a bad thing. So there are cases where intentionally you would not want to trigger your empathic processing. And they don't just have to do with the identity of that person. It could have to do with your social goals, for instance. So let's assume that you're a surgeon and your job is to operate on this person who's in distress. If you triggered empathic processing to that person, you might be overwhelmed by the distress that they're experiencing, and that could hamper your ability to perform the surgery well. So in that case, surgeons might automatically learn to regulate the empathic response to reduce empathy so that it doesn't become a burden when they're performing the task. And so there are a number of factors that are going to determine whether empathy is appropriate or not, such as the identity of who the other person is, as Jesse mentioned. But there are also situational factors, social contextual factors that can do that as well.
It also occurs to me, and I can have you perhaps correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that it is not only that empathy doesn't only help us collaborate and bond as a group, but it can also be helpful in competition. Don't I have to know what you're thinking and put myself in your mind if I'm your competitor?
Yeah, so in psychology, we've started separating empathy from very related processes. So thinking about somebody else's mind, figuring out what someone else is thinking, we think of that as a separate process from empathy. And in fact, if you look at the underlying neural structures, they're different. So if I want to figure out what you're thinking in a competitive situation, I can put myself in your shoes without triggering empathic processing. And that ability to get inside of your head isn't reserved just for people. We can do it with objects and animals. But that's not quite empathy. Again, empathy is this motivation to help part that's missing in a lot of getting in the head, for instance, in a competitive environment.
And Jesse, I guess that's what also distinguishes the psychopath, the ability to figure out what the rules are, to get into your head, know right from wrong, but not feel the pain of doing wrong.
I think the case with psychopaths is a little different. Actually, they're pretty good at figuring out what's in other people's heads. And even though they're impaired in empathy, I think it's a leap to assume that that's why they engage in antisocial behavior. Psychopaths are also missing other important emotions. So, for example, they don't have a sense of guilt. And if you look at the studies on efficacy of emotion in driving helping behavior, pro-social behavior, it doesn't look like empathy is all that effective. Empathy is effective when there's no cost, but as soon as you introduce a cost to helping, as soon as you make helping difficult, people who can experience empathy don't tend to be very helpful. Guilt is a much more powerful motivator. Even when it's highly costly, people will work hard to overcome their guilt, to get rid of it, to make amends. And I think it's this failure to feel a kind of self-hatred or bad feeling towards oneself when engaging in antisocial behavior that's more to blame in the case of psychopaths.
And guilt is not part of the empathic network? Lasana, let me ask you.
Not as far as we can tell. There haven't been lots of studies looking at guilt specifically. Again, this is sort of a new area of research. But the few that are out there have sort of brought out mixed results. So I don't think of guilt as a part of the empathic network per se. Because again, that empathic network is specific to the type of distress.
Right. And that you want to help.
Exactly.
And guilt could be related to your social station, so mm-hmm. your position within the society. Critical if you're going to survive. Everybody's exactly. got to like me. And if I'm guilty and you think ill of me, I could be an outcast and not eat.
Exactly. Guilt is more about reputation management, yeah. let's say, than empathy is.
On the State of Things today, talking about empathy, Lasana Harris, an assistant professor in psychology and neuroscience at Duke, Jesse Prince, distinguished professor of philosophy at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Just ahead, when does empathy cause harm? And we will continue our conversation on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Science Week, and today we're talking about the science of empathy. Lasana Harris is an assistant professor in psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. Jesse Prinz is a distinguished professor of philosophy at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And now we're joined by Pate Skeen. He is a professor. I think you pronounce that Skeen, don't
Skeen,
you?
Skeen, yes.
Pate Skeen is an associate professor of neurobiology at Duke University and a second-year law student. Pate, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to talk about that. Did you flee neurobiology, or is there a connection between the law and...
I definitely did not flee neurobiology. There's a connection. More and more neuroscience and evolutionary biology over the last decade or so have looked at the kinds of decisions that people make and the kinds of responses that people and other animals make to their fellows in the species. And we certainly engage in a lot of processes that enable us to form cooperative societies. And a lot of what law deals with is what we do to enforce those rules of cooperation and why and how we respond when people don't follow the rules.
So it's interesting. We have this maybe biological imperative at some points to empathize, and then we also socialize. How do we enshrine in our legal system, right, in the thing that helps us cooperate, empathy in the law? And that's what you're looking at.
Exactly. And I think one can both ask the question from a rational point of view, what do we want to enshrine in the law? And we can also, I think, use concepts like empathy and our understanding of the biological basis of that to ask what's driving us to form law and to want to implement law that control other people's behavior.
And Jesse, sort of this takes us back to our earlier conversations about when empathy is used, when you enshrine in the law certain empathetic impulses. Some of that can be to protect the ourselves over and against the other, and that can be based again on empathy and then written into law. Segregation, for instance.
Though I think we might put it the opposite way and say law takes care of empathy's shortcomings. The problem with empathy is that it's going to lead to bias, and we need law to make sure that people who are not part of our social group get protected.
Is that how you see it, Pate? Is that the way you're coming at this question?
Yes, I think both in the sense of that we can reason about the benefits and deficits in our sort of intrinsic responses, empathy and other intuitive responses. And having reasoned about them, we can construct law or legal principles to implement the aspects of those we favor.
So does law then protect us from these biological drives, or does it in some way enshrine and celebrate them?
I think I would say both. I think, because one way of looking at what law is trying to do, so the functions of law, is to both reflect these biological drives. We don't like it when other people violate the rules. We have empathy when someone gets hurt or is damaged and are often motivated to help. And one way to help is to enforce some rule that makes people not create those harms. So in that sense, it's reflecting and, as you say, celebrating, embracing those drives. And maybe that's what motivates us to cooperate with the law, to build law and legal systems. At the same time, the legal process doesn't just get everyone together and intuitively respond. It over a long period of time, reflects and rationalizes what we're trying to do with those emotions and tries to articulate that, which gives us a chance to go back and look at these shortcomings and suppress, if you like, or constrain the tendencies that we, on reflection, don't think are so helpful.
So, Lasana, that's when it becomes important to separate what we had all lumped together and called empathy. But the idea of putting yourself in somebody else's place is kind of a rational process that can lead to rational outcomes like the making of laws versus the emotional response of empathy.
Exactly. And that's what makes empathy, again, unique in this conversation, because in order to empathize, I have to get into somebody else's shoes. That's helping me experience the emotion they're experiencing. I also have to understand what they're feeling. But it doesn't stop there. And by taking it to the motivation to help, now it's beginning to match up with what the legal system is doing. And so the legal system is supposed to guarantee the social contract that we have amongst each other. And part of that social contract is pro-social behavior, helping other people that are in need, not taking advantage of other people. And so in that sense, I agree completely with what Pate has just described, in that the law allows us to enshrine principles like empathy and respect them in a way that we might not have without legal rules.
Then the question is sort of how uniquely human is this? I mean, I think about animals and some canine species that are able to cover their tracks. This has always amazed me, that the animal somehow gets that whatever predator, whatever's following them, that it makes tracks, that someone else is paying attention to the tracks and covering them up will give them a better chance to survive. That's a lot of thinking for somebody who's not a human, it seems to me.
Yeah, right? And that's what's remarkable about animals. So if we begin separating empathy from just simply getting inside someone else's head, we find out that animals do have this ability. Animals are able to engage in what we would call social cognition or mentalizing. But it has to be in the right context. So you look at competitive species, and in a competitive context, they're very well aware of what other members of their species are thinking because of that competitive context. It wouldn't exist without it. So most social animals, we think, have some level of ability to get inside other people's heads, which is why you see the behavior you've described. Bringing up canines is interesting because research has shown that they show way more ability similar to humans than many other species do. So because canines have evolved alongside us for the last 1,000 years or so, their ability to not only get inside our heads is there, but they also have the ability to do so across species. So in other species, for instance, they can get inside of the head of, let's say, a competitor. Canines can do that with humans, right? So your dog understands when you point that it needs to go over there. And that's really a unique ability that is found specifically in domesticated animals. So there's something about that domestication process, which involves lots of care and pro-social behavior, that triggers this ability or sort of nourishes this ability to get inside of people's heads. And so separating empathy from that ability is interesting because now you can see the limits of each process and you can look at it cross species and see, well, maybe they don't empathize, but they have the ability to at least get inside each other's heads. And now we can begin reinterpreting their pro-social behavior.
And Jesse, I know you've done research in instances when empathy can lead to harm. Tell us about that.
Well, I think that there are a number of things we've already covered. So empathy, I think, is not as effective as some other emotions in driving pro-social behavior. It also leads to bias preference for the in-group. It's also totally inappropriate when thinking about mass problems, problems that affect large numbers of people. In fact, there are studies showing that if you mention one or two people in need, people are more likely to help, say, to contribute money, than if you mention 1,000 people in need. And that suggests we need a different set of emotions for dealing with cases where we have a large number of people. Empathy is very dyadic. It's me and some other individual. It doesn't help with groups. Empathy is also easily manipulated. Work in courtroom testimony shows that if the plaintiff or the victim are very emotionally expressive, that can sway the sentencing of the jury. And it's very subject to proximity effect. So in a recent calculation, I realized that there are about 24 Katrinas a day in preventable disease and starvation. And what I mean by that is Katrina, the hurricane, killed about 1,800 Americans, and there was a big outpouring of support. But in fact, there are these terrible killers out there, disease and starvation, that are killing at a very mass scale. And people are really not doing very much about it. And I think one reason for that is the whole moral approach that emphasizes empathy leads us to care much more about individual identifiable victims than large numbers of individuals who we can't identify.
And when we simply glorify empathy, we don't examine that phenomenon that you just described, the fact that we're much more likely to respond to it. Well, then there's another interesting phenomenon here that we can empathize. We tend to empathize with the underdog, and you can challenge that. I'll just make that assertion and let you challenge it if you wish. But let's say, all right, people struggling against another stronger, right? There's one people, group of people, and they're struggling against a stronger group of people whose greed and callousness are threatening their way of life. And we can even empathize when the greedy invaders are, let's say, Americans like us, and the underdogs are, oh, say, Japanese, which pretty well describes the 2003 movie Samurai.
Katsumoto has attacked the railroad at the border of his province.
We cannot govern the country in which we cannot travel freely. He must be stopped now. My railroad is a priority for this country.
They're not ready.
The rebels don't have a single rifle. They're savages with bows and arrows.
Whose sole occupation for the last 1,000 years has been war.
You have superior firepower and a larger force. I am ordering the regiment to move against the rebel Katsumoto. You will track him down and engage him.
All right, so notice, though, that we can empathize with the underdog samurai over and against the greedy imperialist Americans, and yet Tom Cruise of all people, has to be in front of the samurai horde in order for us to really empathize, that Hollywood can't really have a samurai defend their own interests if it's going to be an American audience. Jesse, let me start with you. What's happening there?
Yeah, I mean, we see that in cinema all the time. And during the apartheid years, we had a series of American films dealing with apartheid about Stephen Biko and the like. But there always was a white protagonist as well. And, you know, I think that shows one of the challenges in trying to get people to empathize. If you don't bring the in-group in, it's really very difficult. We now have this debate about gun violence. And the truth is, most gun violence in America is black on black, and white legislators are just not that motivated to get involved with this until we see a shooting in Connecticut where a lot of the victims are white.
Lasana, can you? What do you think is happening there as well? Because interestingly enough, the audience is expected to turn on its own, right? I mean, those are Americans there. They're clearly on the wrong side of justice. We can do that part of the equation. We're drawn into that. And yet, you know, certainly, so we can buy into that part of the story.
Right. And human beings are complicated, and we have multiple identities. So there are many ways for us to identify with a protagonist. Nationalist identities is one of them. But in the case of, let's say, the samurais, if they're extolling values that we hold as near and dear to our identities, then that can be sufficient to trigger identification and subsequent identity. So if someone, for instance, your underdog example, represents something that we believe to be truing us, a sense of perseverance, a sense of determination, then we can identify along that abstract concept and now trigger empathic processing. So you don't have to have identity just along nationalist or race-related lines. You can have identities based simply on sharing the same birthday or exhibiting the same types of behavior, wearing the same color of shirt today. And so human beings' flexibility allow them, through their multiple identities, to decide what's salient and important and relevant and identify along those lines if necessary. And so what Hollywood does a good job of doing is finding sort of common core values in American society and reflecting them even in alien characters or characters that are animals when, you know, they're doing cartoons, things like that.
Now, Peita does suggest, though, that if you're going to build a legal system around this, that there has to be a kind of evolution of your system. In other words, you're going to refer back to those values that your group held in common as you begin to build this legal structure. You're just not going to pull laws out of thin air or write laws that don't somehow connect with the experience of that particular group in that time.
I think that's right, and I think you used a good example of segregation laws there. We have in our history at times when lawmakers, whether that's legislators or courts or others, recognized a set of values and empathized because they identified with some groups but didn't identify with other groups, and then, and in a sense, could not see that a legal principle that was articulated applied in a different way than we would recognize now. And I think one thing that can happen in legal reflection or the evolution of a legal process is to describe that as the process of identification. There was famously during Justice Sotomayor's confirmation process some debate over whether a judge should be empathetic. And I think one way of looking at that is to say that one thing that that diversity of background might bring, or an ability to empathize might bring, is whether it's a court or a jury or anyone else making decisions about legal decisions about processes, the ability to imagine beyond one's personal experience, to empathize with different parties, and then be able to use that information not to make a gut feeling, but to look at the reasoning that you're bringing to bear to see if, in fact, you are applying the law equally to both sides.
Well, imagination is a concept that we haven't brought into the conversation yet, and yet you would think essential to the idea of empathy, what it is and what it isn't. So I want to bring into the conversation now Ralph Severese. Ralph is the author of Reasonable People, A Memoir of Autism and Adoption. He's also an associate professor of English at Grinnell College and a Duke Humanities Writ Large Fellow. Welcome to you, Ralph. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
You adopted a child who was labeled severely autistic and retarded. So tell us what DJ was like at the time when you adopted him.
So we adopted him 1 month shy of his sixth birthday. He was in diapers. He had never been given glasses, so his vision was really, really bad. He also had what's called an auditory processing disorder, so he was not deaf, but he had great difficulty decoding spoken language. So he was pretty much alienated from what we would think of as culture. At the same time, he had an enormous ability to cathect, to connect. My wife and I like to joke that he adopted us. And that tells us something, I think, really, really important, that on some sort of core level, language may not be necessary. That there's some kind of communication happening. And that was the first moment that I really began to question a lot of the literature about autism, saying that autistics have no empathy, no imagination, no sociality, all of this stuff that we've all heard again and again and again.
Where does that – Lasana, let me ask you where that idea comes from. The reason we're talking about autism is there's a common belief that that's the problem here. The lack of empathy is a defining characteristic. Where do we get that idea?
I think that might have fallen out of the scientific process. And so in order to do experiments in autistics, you tend to get participants who aren't severely autistic. And then you compare them to healthy controls. And so if they show any difference in performance, you view it as a decrement. You add to that the stigma of any type of mental disorder. And researchers, I think, are predisposed towards thinking that these people just aren't as good as normal healthy controls because of the myriad of behavioral problems associated with them. So it's quite possible that as a field, again, we're humans doing this research, we may have let our own sort of inherent biases influence the way in which we view these populations of people, the way in which we view autistics. And so speaking with Ralph over the last few months since he's been at Duke has been fascinating because I've begun to learn of all the things that autistics can do. And it's just a very different focus than you typically would find in the scientific community.
Yeah, and I think that's thank you for saying that, because some of the newer research, and this picks up on a lot of the key elements of the discussion thus far, has shown that you can't just talk about empathy as one process, and that at least in autism, people are starting to talk about emotional empathy, cognitive empathy, and motor empathy. And increasingly, we're seeing just how many motor challenges autistics have. So the business of discerning whether somebody is empathetic depends upon the successful motor performance, even if it only means facial muscles, the ability to look like you are deeply distraught at something that's happened to somebody else. And this newer research is showing that actually autistics have a surfeit of emotional empathy and have challenges with cognitive and motor empathy. And let me just tell one very quick anecdote. When my nephew died of a brain tumor some 8 years ago, my son was really, really distraught, and my sister-in-law was incredibly distraught. And she really didn't want to hear from those of us who had never lost a child. And since my son had lost his parents and his sister, I think she was ready to listen to him. And I just taught my son the word reasonable. He was interested in the fact that it could mean a modest amount or tied to the rational. And he went over to his little machine and typed out to her, "Do you have reasonable people to help you with your hurt?" And we might not say it that way, but that's clearly a kind of empathy, and it meant an enormous amount to my sister-in-law, and she kept the little thing that she had printed out in her purse. But to get my son to that point, we had to work forever with occupational therapists, physical therapists, on the motor stuff. He was included in a regular classroom, exposed to all of the emotional and social enrichment that has allowed those of us in this room to be competent, empathetic actors.
On the State of Things today, we are talking about empathy. Ralph Severese is the author of Reasonable People, a memoir of autism and adoption, and associate professor of English at Grinnell College in Iowa, and the Duke Humanities Writ Large Fellow as well. Also with us, Lasana Harris, an assistant professor in psychology and neuroscience at Duke, Jesse Prinz, a distinguished professor of philosophy at the Graduate Center of City University of New York, and Pate Skeen is an associate professor of neurobiology at Duke. And our conversation on the State of Things continues after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about empathy today. Lasana Harris is with us, assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke. Jesse Prinz, distinguished professor of philosophy at City University of New York. Pate Skeen is an associate professor of neurobiology at Duke and a second-year law student. And Ralph Severese is the author of Reasonable People, a memoir of autism and adoption. And he teaches, he's got dual appointments at Grinnell, and he's also a Duke Humanities Writ Large Fellow here at Duke. So, Ralph, tell us a little more. You decided that what the experts were telling you was this is a child who would never be able to communicate. Mm-hmm. And you worked on him and thought you could. What did you do?
Well, I should say that my wife is an inclusion specialist. So she knew a lot about how to teach literacy, for example, to students who couldn't talk or had difficulty learning in customary ways. And a lot of it was basic drilling. I remember in the first few years we had my son DJ, we had every object in the house had a photograph attached to it, a computer icon, an American Sign Language sign, and the word. And we were trying to immerse DJ in a kind of, you know, print-rich environment where I still remember trying to teach him, for example, to reach for a photograph of Oreos as opposed to the bag of Oreos. And the only way he was going to get the Oreos is if he reached for the photograph. And it took a long time. A long, long time. And I would say that had we not stuck in there, and there was plenty of indication this wasn't working, that the concept of representation was very difficult for him. But when he did break the code, he moved like lightning. And he's now just finished his first semester at Oberlin College. He uses a text-to-voice synthesizer, one finger typing, one word at a time to communicate. And if I may be a proud father for 1 second, I will tell you that he got two A minuses and an A, which is a lot better than his father, who is currently on fellowship at Duke, did in his first semester of his undergraduate career.
You are a poet and a writer, and you talked about one of the things that we think about autistic people is that they don't empathize. Certainly, reading literature is not going to move them, and you found just the opposite.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Even someone like Temple Grandin, who famously said in her profile with Oliver Sacks in Sacks's book called Anthropologist on Mars that, you know, she really didn't understand Shakespeare and Romeo and Juliet. But I have lots and lots of non-autistic students in my intro to literature classes who don't understand Romeo and Juliet. But presto, I give them a different kind of novel that may relate to their experience, and suddenly they relate. And similarly, Temple's now talking about reading science fiction. I think this business of managing who the other is, what they can do, what limits there are, I think that's a really, really perilous business. And one of the things that my wife and I have tried to do is be open to surprise and to be open to difference. that there are different ways to do the same thing. And we're seeing that. And I'm teaching autistics how to write poetry. I presented some of this poetry at a lecture at the Brain Institute. And I think people were shocked because that's not the picture they get from the culture.
And how empathic he becomes and became when he was reading certain. I mean, talk about reading Huckleberry Finn, for instance.
Yeah, that was very hard. And can you believe that somebody who has a PhD in American literature did not really focus on the fact that Huck was an orphan or that his father had tried to kill him as my son's birth mother had tried to kill him? And so here we start reading this. And he is really, really anxious, beyond anxious, agitated. And it really got me to think about, you know, general principles in literary study, that readers are different people who bring different expectations to the process of reading, but also how do we do this business of engaging with other people's stories that are often emotionally overwhelming and difficult. And the great thing is, rather than sort of follow the customary narrative that I had to teach DJ what Huck was feeling, I actually had to teach DJ to distance himself from what was happening to him. And DJ at first was really annoyed that Huck was using a comic tone to relate some of his real hardships. But then by the end, he had what he discovered, what I want all students to discover, that by employing a comic tone, Twain actually delivers the horror of slavery, of child abuse underneath or in the gap between that tone and what doesn't get said.
Well, it's interesting that he not only resented the comic tone about Huck toward himself, a situation that he might identify with,
right,
since he had a similar childhood in many ways, but also Jim, and couldn't get past the fact that, look, you're talking about a man who is enslaved, who's not in charge of his own destiny. There's nothing funny about this, says your son.
No, and it's funny. You know, his one good foster home, very good foster home, was with an African-American family in northern Florida. And they were a very, very proud, politically active family. And so I think that's where he picked up. All of his heroes are African-American. He said to me, and I don't quite know what to do with this, I look to Harriet Tubman every day for encouragement. Because, you know, think about it. One of the tough things for my son and for other autistics like him, he is really conspicuous as a disabled person in largely non-disabled environments. And to have the courage to be that visible as a 19 or 20-year-old, oh my God, I would not have wanted that kind of attention in college.
Jesse Prinz, as you hear this story and as someone who has thought deeply and written about empathy, what does this tell you about what we know and perhaps what we don't know about empathy?
Well, I think it's a very important story to pay attention to. Autism is very much part of our contemporary society, and it's extremely crucial that we get over the bias that says people with autism lack empathy. Temple Grandin, who's written quite a bit about what it's like to be a high-functioning person with autism, has written about empathy in much of her work and has a career that's based on her own empathy for non-human animals. But in the lab, we see it too. So, for example, you mentioned psychopaths. And James Blair, who did some of the most pioneering recent experimental work with psychopaths, found in his dissertation work that people with empathy people with autism are extremely empathetic. He would show photographs of individuals in pain, say people crying, and psychopaths showed very little response. But he had a control group that had empathy, and they very, very strongly showed a response, an empathetic response to what they were seeing on the screen. So I think Ralph's narrative here is one that everyone should pay attention to.
And Lasana, Ralph was talking about the distance between emotional empathy, cognitive empathy, and motor empathy. Motor being, I can't show it, and maybe I won't react, maybe I won't do anything to help you. Now distinguish cognitive empathy from emotional empathy.
Right. I think it's exactly as we've been talking before. So the idea of getting inside of someone's head is what we can call cognitive empathy or mentalizing social cognition. You'll find that in science we use many names to describe the same thing. And so that's cognitive empathy, and that's what I think you can see evidence for in other species, for instance. Emotional empathy is different. Emotional empathy is the idea of feeling the emotion that the other person is feeling. So not the cognitive act of making an inference about their mind, but the more emotive act of experiencing their emotion. And that's where we have some debate as to whether other animals can experience it. There is some emotional contagion research suggesting that other animals can infer the emotion that members of their species are showing. But that research is a very small body of literature compared to the cognitive empathy research. And finally, motor empathy is what I would consider imitation, and that's where you find the domain of mirror neurons, for instance. And so as human beings, we have the capacity to observe an action and display the action as well. And motor empathy focuses on that ability, or ability to mimic, to imitate, which it turns out facilitates social interactions, right? You like people better who subtly mimic you versus people who do not. Not when you're aware of it, but if it's subtly happening and you don't consciously notice it. And so these are all three different things that help us become social creatures. And so it's interesting to start comparing between them. But you look in the brain and you find three very separate systems for these three different processes, suggesting that they're not all the same type of process.
Do we know the impact of trauma? I'm imagining now, I'm speculating that if one was particularly gifted at emotional intelligence, if I could feel what you're feeling, there may be a point at which it's too much. And as a matter of self-preservation, I shut down some aspect.
And our research demonstrates exactly that. So we've demonstrated a phenomenon where people look at homeless people as less than human. So they dehumanize the homeless. You rather view them more like a pile of rubbish than as an actual human being. You will walk your dog right past a homeless person paying more attention to your dog than the homeless guy. And if you think about it for a minute, biologically speaking, in a Darwinian sense, that's incredible, right? That's a member of your species and you're showing more compassion and empathy towards another species member. Turns out that people high in empathy do more of that. And the rationale behind it is that they become so overwhelmed feeling the distress of that homeless person that they learn to avoid triggering those feelings in the first place. And so empathy can be a burden. Someone that's high in emotional empathy, for instance, probably has a very difficult time. They're the people that can't watch different types of movies because they have to cover their eyes. They don't want to see the other person suffering or crying. There are some people who extended beyond humans to other animals as well, like Temple Grandin. But I know of people who can, for instance, stand seeing roadkill because just the idea of empathizing with this thing that's now dead on the floor is too much of a burden for them. And so you can regulate that emotional response by doing things like thinking less about the person as a human being and other different strategies.
And I think that I see that all of the time with the group of classical autistics that my wife and I work with. In fact, you know, that the need to shut down, if you add the business of sensory processing, and so that often that's overwhelming to autistics, and then you add the emotional stuff, and you suddenly come upon folks that seem to have desperately need a way to shut down, to manage this incredible sort of overload. And I think, again, the danger is mistaking that for not feeling,
right,
when in fact it's the opposite.
And Ralph, you've also speculated that one of the things that might be happening with people who are autistic is that the transfer from the right hemisphere to the left that takes place as we learn to learn differently may not take place. And so there's a deeper connection in some ways.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting. I mean, there are clear differences in the corpus callosum, you know, which connects the two hemispheres. I mean, Lasana and I disagree a little bit or bicker a little bit about what the significance of some of these things. The reason why I bring up the right hemisphere is because of literary things, how we process, for example, novel metaphors, but also a range of psychiatric conditions that seem to involve, you know, an overactive right hemisphere.
So tell us what happens in the right and the left so that we know it. We get a good picture of what you're talking about.
Yeah, so you know, at least at this point where we are in what scientists have told us is that novel metaphors largely depend upon the right hemisphere for decoding and integration, whereas clichés, interestingly enough, depend upon the left hemisphere. And there are different accounts of this, and this is still, you know, emerging. It used to be that we thought all metaphors were left, then it was all metaphors were right, and now we're split. But it is interesting, at least to some scientists, that the right hemisphere seems to be disproportionately involved in psychiatric conditions, but also involved in an imaginative, creative, novel endeavors. And I don't want to go, you know, I already feel like I'm a little bit out on a plank on a pirate ship, but I don't want to go out too far. But I do think it's worth thinking about the relationship between these two, and including empathy and its right hemispheric components.
Lasana, if he's out on a plank, if you had to draw him back, how would you do it?
Very difficult. I think. So in the field, you find that some scientists believe in the specialization of hemispheres and others don't. And I'm more in the latter camp. But those who do believe in the specialization of hemispheres use the metaphor of the right as sort of the more creative, artistic, emotional hemisphere, and the left is the sort of rational actor. And so using that metaphor, I think Ralph is exactly correct. And so you'll find empathy perhaps in the right hemisphere, given that metaphor.
Pete, I want to talk to you about what happens, given what we've talked about just a minute ago, the idea that you can be so overwhelmed with empathy that you turn yourself off. At the collective level, when we get to then, you know, making laws, you can sound very rational about making a set of laws that really could be possibly appealing to our just sense of overwhelming grief. We can't handle it, and therefore we won't. I mean, is that a danger? And once we raise this to the level of architecture, legal architecture,
I think it raises some interesting questions. Some questions that, as a neurobiologist, I'm very interested in pursuing in law, so I don't really know the answers to those. But I think you can one way to hypothesize how legal reasoning and legal decisions might play out is that law is trying to take the kinds of decisions that we would make one-on-one when we can process empathetic responses, when we can mentalize about an individual. And law is trying to build sets of rules that let us apply those on a larger scale and to circumstances that we may not be prepared to handle on an individual basis because they're so large, they're beyond our scope of understanding, they involve people with whom we don't identify, or they just involve experiences that we don't have, serious crimes or terrible injuries that happen to people or something of that kind. So I think one way of looking at this neural division between the processing and emotional response of empathy and the motivation to help, and then the reasoning about what to do and to translate that into an output is something that I think you can look at law as doing, taking those basic, if you like, popular public desire to have certain help occur, to limit damage and so forth, and then trying to reason about it and construct law that does that in a principled way.
As long as you understand, you have enough stories and enough experience with other people and other experiences built into the system. So if only one kind of people with one set of experiences are writing the laws, then people who have a very different experience in that environment, their story might not be integrated into the legal framework.
I think that's exactly right. And as a novice lawyer, a more experienced neurobiologist, one of the things I'm very interested in is, can we take that approach as neurobiologists and ask, is that what the law's doing?
You know, I've only got about 30 seconds left, Ralph, but I want to ask you what you've learned about empathy with your experience from DJ.
Well, just that it comes in many, many forms, and we should be very, very wary about making judgments about different kinds of people in different contexts with different experiences. At the same time that it's possible to traverse the spaces between us, those differences. And I think that's what our adoptive family has tried to show.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Ralph Savarese is an associate professor of English at Grinnell College and a Duke Humanities Writ Large Fellow. His book is called Reasonable People, A Memoir of Autism and Adoption. Pate Skeen is an associate professor of neurobiology at Duke. Jesse Prinz, distinguished professor of philosophy at the City University of New York. Lasana Harris, assistant professor in psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. Thank all of you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to have you here, and thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.